Good afternoon, Larry.
Hi, Andy.
This is a kind of strange day. I'm driving down the interstate, I-75, just outside of Atlanta. My phone rings, and you are 10 miles ahead of me, 15 miles ahead of me on the interstate.
Barely 10 miles ahead.
And so we just picked a random house. We broke in, and we set up shop so we could record an episode. We're both in transit, traveling, not necessarily the right equipment, so we figured we'd try and throw something down. This will get released. Whatever, I can't do dates this quickly.
A week from tonight.
It'll be released. Well, but so today's June 11th, so this will be released in a week, whatever 7 is. So is that the 18th?
That'll be the 18th.
And we're just coming back from the conference. We're gonna touch on some conference follow-up, maybe some ideas about what we got out of the conference with the really powerhouse kind of speakers that were there this past week, or weekend. And then we are going to just kind of improv on two or three subjects that seem relevant from events at the conference, not to mention good old Judge Persky. So why don't we start off with Judge Persky?
Well, you didn't tell the listeners who did the breaking into the house.
I'm sure if we actually say that, then there could be problems with the law enforcement apparatus.
Oh, okay, the law
If
enforcement
we don't if we
apparatus.
don't mention any names, then everybody's good.
So actually, I have a friend with a mother-in-law quarters that I'm fortunate to use, and we were very close to that. I was going to be spending the nights. Which means that we had a have a nice environment to sit in the living room and do the podcast right here.
Groovy. Yeah, it's a nice place. It's very well, like, acoustically prepared for us, which is really good. All right, so Judge Persky, so help me if I've got the oh, you know what? So there was a speaker at the conference, and you were really in tune with him saying so.
That would be Mr. Feige. He
And we
must have said it enough times that we could fund our trip to the conference.
I will try and say so less. But the person that brought in that comment on the podcast is probably, if he saw Mr. Feige, he would be very, very, very annoyed. But everyone does it. We've been sort of noticing how much people say so in conversations. Everyone goes, "So I was thinking, so I was going over here." It is just like the word of the modern era.
And I'm trying really hard, but each time I move from one thought to the next, I find myself pausing. What do I use in place of so to begin the next sentence? It causes a pause, but it's a good thing to struggle with because people do find things like that repetitive usage inappropriate. I know I do, so I appreciate the feedback. I really do.
Tell me this though, during the mock hearings, Barb Wright, when she was asked a question by the senators, she would say, I think, chairperson to the senator. And I asked Jeff, I can't think of his last name, the attorney, the PD from Ohio.
That would be Mr. Gamso, Jeffrey Gamso.
He said, well, consider it like that pause word, like you're saying or so, that it would give you 1 or 2 seconds that your brain starts collecting the thoughts, setting up the assembly line of the words. Is that when you've testified or anything like that, do you have words like that, some sort of like catchphrase, go-to catchphrase that you
And
say?
what was her phrase?
Well, she would say when she, well, what would be the issue of XYZ of this bill? Chairperson to the senator, the issue with that would be.
That is actually not the reason why that is done. It's protocol. All the conversation is directed toward in a committee hearing to the chair, and if you're watching the body as the whole, if the senator of the house is in session, you're always Mr. Speaker, Madam Speaker. If a colleague asks you a question in debate, if that colleague says, "Can I ask the gentleman from Newton County, or whoever was sponsoring the bill, and Mr. Chairman, I'd like to address that." So it works that way as a matter of respect. You don't direct your comments to anywhere other than to the chairman and to the person chairperson, I should say, because chairs are often female. But it's Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, and senator, whichever a representative, whatever. So that's just formality. There's it's not a build up or anything.
Is it required for every, is, and first of all, is it required?
It's not required from lay people. The members of the committee, the members of the body are expected to adhere to that. They're trained in and they're refreshed when they don't follow that rule. My senator, I remember in his first term, he was being an attorney. He had his natural tendency was to do rapid fire questions, and finally a witness said, "I'm not in a courtroom here." And the chairperson said, "Let me remind the senator that all the questions are directed toward the chair." If you're a lay witness, it's not as critical. You gain more credibility if you know how the rules work, what the formalities are, and what the expectations are. The more credible you are, if you play by their rules, you're in their house. I mean, it's your house, it's the people of the state, but you're in these are the expectations, and the more alert and the more proper way that you conduct yourself. It's like going to the courtroom. You can go to the courtroom wearing shorts. Very few judges will tell you to leave, but what might have been a diversion to traffic school with no points on your record after 90 days may very well become the points on your record plus a $75 fine plus all the court fees because you did not take enough time to dress up and go to court and show respect, and that tie and your honor could have made all the difference.
And we've talked about tattoos probably offline, and not that I'm opposed to them. I don't particularly care for them, but I don't really care. But having tattoos all over your face and neck, whatever, would do something similar instead of addressing them in their ultra formal setting.
Well, the tattoo stuff, people can't easily remove those, but they can cover their shirt sleeves. They can do things to show respect for, I mean, the institutional of church where people were always formal. Many of those have broken down. The respect for the court, the respect for everything, it still serves you well. There are a lot of older people like myself who appreciate that when someone is proper and respectful. And it can very well work to your benefit, and it would in a legislative setting. The more you know how to conduct yourself, the better it's going to serve you in terms of how they respond to you.
Well, we'll circle back to some of the conference stuff here in a minute. Let's talk about Judge Persky, who is a California judge. I believe he was appointed by Bush. I'm not positive of that, but I believe it goes back a president or two when he was appointed. But he's the judge that sentenced Brock Turner to what people call a very light sentence of 6 months for sexual assault of an inebriated female. Is that close?
Pretty close. I wouldn't believe he would have been appointed by the president. He's a California state judge.
Oh, okay.
It would have
So not a federal judge.
he could have been on the bench a very long time and been appointed by Governor Ronald Reagan
Okay, right.
or
Okay.
one of the former Republican governors. But he's a Superior Court judge, which is Georgia, where we are right now, has Superior Court judge. But that's a felony level judge that handles the general docket, and he was recalled. June 5th, which I guess would be a week ago tomorrow, overwhelmingly recalled by right at 60% of the vote, and the sentence that was imposed was recommended by the pre-sentence report from the probation department, reflective of his remorse and his lack of criminal record, and it was going to get his attention because he had 5 years of sex offender probation plus whatever the registration obligations will follow him for the remainder of his life, depending on the state, and then it set off an outcry, and the Me Too movement and the victims' advocates started a recall process, and they successfully culminated the recall a week ago, and he's going to be off the bench, is off the bench.
Right. And the reason why this is important is me being a very lay person, to make a comparison to the federal level, they are appointed by the president, they are then confirmed in the Senate, and they are there for life. No matter what they do, it would be very difficult to repeal a federal judge, and I'm thinking of the Supreme Court justices. It'd be damn near impossible to get rid of one, no matter what their decisions are. And I'm thinking, in my understanding of the way the Constitution is written, the House, it's 2 years, it's a very fast-moving body of people that we, as the voters, we can change our opinion quickly. Then you have a little bit of a slower group of people, the senators, who would put a stopgap measure in there to keep things from moving just all over the place fast. And then you have the Supreme Court to really lock in things so that we can't have a different country every 2 years. So this puts, a big piece of momentum in place to keep things stable for long periods of time. Now you've got, in California, I guess they vote their judges in. Obviously, they can vote them out. And so now judges would potentially be scared to make, from their opinion, the right decision. Obviously, the public disagrees, but now they have to then weigh public opinion in on what their decisions are, and they should be, feels like they should be exempt from those kind of opinions.
That is what the framers intended. I believe it's Article 3, when we talk about the federal system of Article 3, judges are appointed and confirmed, and then they can remain on the bench for life. And it's almost impossible to remove them. There have been a few impeached, but it's very few. I think Judge Alcee Hastings was the most recent one that comes to my mind that was impeached. It's usually some criminality, not for decisions that have been made on the
Roughly what
bench.
year was that?
What's that?
What year? Roughly.
It's maybe in the 90s,
Oh, okay. It's been that recent?
but it's a rare thing that a federal judge is impeached. And then, as when I was a much younger man, I remember historically that there was an attempt to remove a Supreme Court justice, but the name is escaping me. But it's a rarity that a federal judge is removed. Now, directly below the federal judgeships, there's federal magistrate judges, and they go through a different process. They don't go through that confirmation process of the Senate, and they can be removed because the federal judges in the district appoint the magistrate judges, and the magistrate judges have fewer powers than a full district judge. A very few transition to become a full federal judge and get an appointment and confirmation. But a magistrate judge at the federal level is a fairly prestigious position. There are a lot of people seeking that. What we have in California is now that Judge Persky has been recalled, it's beginning of many things to come, because the public opinion you mentioned has always been in the background when judges make decisions. When they're elected, they think about public opinion, but they're going to think a lot more about public opinion, because typically, with the short attention span that the public has, if you have a 4 or 6 year term, you do something and you're one or two or three of a longer period of time, it's all but forgotten. Well, now with this organized movement and the monitoring that's going to start taking place, because now they've succeeded the first time since, I believe, 1932 or 36, that a California judge has been recalled. Which means that they now know it can be done. They have that power, and they will begin to monitor judges' sentencing practices, kind of like the Mothers Against Drunk Driving and the Advocates for DWI. They have similar monitoring programs, and they score judges on how tough they are and how many cases they dismiss and how they sentence. I expect that group in California will begin monitoring the Superior Court judges, and the those who sentence leniently, and lenient has now been changed because there's a mandatory 3-year minimum, which was not required when Brock Turner was sentenced, but now there's a 3-year minimum for the identical charges. That's now the lenient standard, because that's the base.
So, in the wake of which one of the directions I was going to go, if the people don't like the 6-month sentence, then get your politician to introduce a bill to make it a longer sentence. They
And they
don't
did,
have,
and they did.
and they, but they don't have to get rid of the judge for doing it. He did what he was allowed to do. He was within the guidelines of the law that the people voted in place. He abided by the guidelines of the legislature, of what the will of the people was. He did all of that. If they wanted something harsher, they could have done that 10, 20, whatever number of years ago to make that happen.
Well, he had, as I understand it, up to 14 years of potential exposure. The prosecution was seeking a longer period of time. But the one component of the judicial system recommended, which probation, the PSRs were highly relied upon, and the probation department recommended the more lenient sentence because of the factors that suggest leniency. Someone else looking at those factors may have not weighed them as heavily, but these were not exactly liberal do-gooders. The probation system is a part of the law enforcement apparatus.
And if we let's just posit that Brock Turner would go on to be the next Michael Phelps and be some superstar swimmer. He was a swimmer. That was like the big deal of it. And compare him to, what's the baseball player up in the Northwest?
Lucas or Luke?
Luke Heimlich.
Heimlich, yeah.
So he did his he got convicted, but as a juvenile and everything was sealed. But then the registry, this is where I'm going with this, the registry kicks in and puts all this extra baggage on him. Overlay that over Brock Turner, the 6 month sentence is, whether that was 6 months, 3 years, 10 years, kind of irrelevant. When the registry kicks in, is going to just be a massive amount of baggage that he's going to have to carry, just like the baseball player is going to have to carry as well.
Yes, well, I was one of the people who predicted that no major league team would pick him up, and that is not a surprise because it would just be a public relations nightmare. Same thing with Brock Turner; his career is effectively over as far as competitive swimming. They don't earn the money that professional baseball players, but his swimming career is over.
And correct me if I'm wrong, the registry is a civil regulatory scheme, not punishment, right?
As the courts see it, in most instances, it's a civil regulatory scheme.
And as a civil regulatory scheme, I'm pretty sure that there's nothing other than, if you don't renew your driver's license, you don't go to jail. If you
Not as
get
a
caught
general,
driving with it, I get.
not as a general rule, you wouldn't go to jail on most regular failure to comply with most regulatory schemes.
Jail is considered punishment?
Yes, but the registry is such an important function as far as the law enforcement and the public, and the perception is that we have to treat failure to comply much more seriously than we do a normal regulatory scheme.
But just failing to update your address. Sorry, I move literally to the apartment next door. I'm basically physically in the same place, but now I've created an obligation to send me back to prison.
You've created you've and the funny thing is when you move to the place next door, the sad thing is not anything funny about it. The sad thing is that with the laws the way they are, you may move next door and you may not be able to get the documentation that satisfies them when you move next door because you as I understand it, I don't deal with this, but as I understand it, when you go to the registry offices, they're demanding in some instances significant proof that you're living there. And if you just move and you try to comply and you go notify them, you don't have the proof. How do you get the proof? You don't have a utility bill. You don't have identification with that address on there. You don't have a lease because you're shacking up with somebody and sharing floor space because of your indigency. How do you prove that you're there?
There was a session by Lori Jo who was going over a lot of this stuff, and she brought up an example where I'm going to get the details all kinds of wrong, but just to go along with that, where there was some mechanism that forced you to surrender your driver's license, something along with the registry. And by doing so, then it becomes very difficult for you to get a bank account, for you to establish residency, to establish power, to prove your residency, to get a driver's license. And she laid out it was roughly 15 things that just cascaded on down the chain that gradually put you into this whirlpool of purgatory of never being able to prove anything about your existence. You're just this body. You're almost like Tom Hanks in the movie Terminal, where while he was traveling, while he was in an international water, his country had gone into, like a coup. And now nobody recognizes his country as even existing anymore. And when he lands, his passport isn't valid anymore. And he's just nowhere. He doesn't exist. And that's what this whole thing seemed like with it sounds similar. And do you think that it's just straight up nefarious to create this? Or do you think it's just lack of insight to see what the collateral consequences are going forward of the registry and all those things?
I believe it's both. I believe it's nefarious, and I believe that people truly don't understand. We run into it with other situations, like with failure to pay child support, driver's license canceled, and the cascading effect of that. I believe that there are a number of states that specially mark driver's licenses, and you have to turn in your existing driver's license upon conviction or shortly thereafter. And then of course, when you register, you try to get a new driver's license reflecting that address, because they have the law that that it has to be reflective of your true address, and you can't prove all the things that I didn't get the chance to sit through the workshop. But if you surrender your proof, your picture ID, your governmental issued picture ID, it's hard to get another picture ID once you don't have a picture ID, because everybody wants a photo ID issued by the government that's valid. You can't just go in with a birth certificate, thanks to Real ID, which was passed and shoved down the state's throat about 10 years ago, I think, or 12 years ago, 2006. So issuing identification is real stringent to meet federal standards, because that's how supposedly 9/11 terrorists were able to get 20 some odd driver's licenses from various states that had lax issuance standards. So you have the cascading effect of turning in a driver's license, not being able to get another piece of identification, and it makes the person virtually non-existent. And if you didn't, if we don't have our papers, how do we do anything?
There, I'm bringing up images of Nazi Germany, and some, Gestapo comes up to you and says, "Show me your papers." But now you don't have any papers.
Don't have them because they took them.
But they set up a whole framework for you to just inch by inch just lose it all if you don't stay ahead of the curve. Whereas a normal person, you can sign affidavits, etc., and get those documents back and build up your paperwork, your history of who you are as a citizen. But it becomes very difficult under these civil regulatory scheme.
Well, our civil regulatory scheme is going to remain civil until we convince the courts of how punitive it is, and that's going to be costly to work a case properly at the lower court and take it up and get the Supreme Court to grant review. And I'm not looking for that to happen anytime in the foreseeable future. There is a case that people are looking at before the Supreme Court right now, the Gundy case, but it really isn't going to deal with registration so much as it's going to deal with delegation by Congress. It's not really a registration case per se.
You've brought that up. One of the things that came up in the conference, I'm pretty sure it was by Paul Dubling, is about jurisdictional authority in the way that the laws are written. That I all I can come up with is vague. It's not very specific wording, and it leaves it to the sheriff's office for them to implement their whatever their policies, their procedures are for checking on registrants. And the way Dubling brought it up was that you immediately have a vehicle to go in there and challenge things, because they can do what they want, and that's not necessarily constitutional for them to do what they want to do. But the way the law is written, it's very vague that they can just run with it however they see fit. And since they're the executive branch, now you have, I guess, kind of like a Judge Dredd situation, where you have the executor also making what the rules are, and that's a conflict of interest.
I agree with Paul. But what is even more troubling is that in most of the instances, or many of the instances, there's no requirement that there be any verification done. When you look at the statutory scheme, it says the person shall register and they shall notify, but it doesn't say that the registering authority has to go out and in person verify. They've invented this because it's one of the things that the public can be. When you're an elected sheriff, it's really nice to go out and say, "We did 945 home visits in the last 12 months, check in on our 132 sex offenders to make sure that we know that you're safe." And that's more likely to get a vote. And I think one of our presenters mentioned that when you get elected to anything, a particular sheriff, your deputies essentially become your campaign staff. Do you remember that
He
presentation?
did. I totally, yeah. I think that was the AG, I think.
That's who it was. Yeah, it was the AG, the sheriff. So the sheriff, in the case of registration, more often than not, it's within the sheriff's departments, and those are generally elected. My grand scheme is someday that we move away from the sheriff's departments or even law enforcement, because if it's a regulatory scheme should not be handled by law enforcement. So therefore, I want to get it more into a motor vehicle type of registration status, where you go in, give your local motor vehicle people the information, and just like you give your local motor vehicle your registration information to become a driver, they check your eyes and give you a road test if you have never had one before, and a sign test and the various things, and they pronounce you in compliance with the regulatory scheme. And that's what I'd like to see. If this is truly going to be a regulatory scheme, let's make it a regulatory scheme and have people register with the regulatory body, and that be the end of it until they have a change.
So to flesh out what the Attorney General, the former Attorney General, said, he just it would just be a beast that feeds on itself. So the sheriff goes out and does some compliance checks. So he's working solo. Let's just say he's in a smallish area, and he goes out and does some compliance checks and finds out 20% of the people in his area are not compliant. Public's outraged, so they fund him to help him get some more deputies on staff to institute more compliance checks. By doing more compliance checks, they go find out more people aren't compliant, sleeping on the girlfriend's couch or whatever, and that then feeds them to have more and more and more and more. And next thing you know, you've got 10 officers sitting there, and as soon as you walk in the door, they want to arrest you.
That is correct, and as the former Attorney General pointed out, they become campaign staff for the sheriff, because most people that work for a sheriff generally support the sheriff. Not always, particularly in a large department where you have hundreds of deputies, you can have. But if you're working in a department that has 50, 75 deputies, the sheriff generally doesn't hire people who doesn't support him or her. And so those become your de facto campaign workers on the public dole, helping you stay in office as sheriff.
Tell me about the politics side of a sheriff. Do they typically run on a two-party ticket, or are they just, I'm so and so running for sheriff?
Typically, in the states I've lived in, it's a partisan thing. So your sheriffs run as Democrats or Republicans typically.
Shouldn't that not be partisan?
That argument could be made.
Shouldn't they just, like, here's what the law is, I'm going to go enforce the law. It is not my job to determine. I'm going to execute what the legislature has written. I shouldn't, if it says that they are supposed to register every 6 months, I'm just responsible for whether they have registered every 6 months. If the law doesn't say I'm supposed to go do compliance checks, where does that even come from?
They invented that to. For public relations purposes, they know that their voters want to see them in the community doing things. It would be like traffic enforcement, where there's problems with speeders. It would be like if there was a burglary problem, where they would be doing prevention and teaching people how to make their homes more secure. They send out officers to do community training. It's PR. The public generally responds well to sheriffs using their deploying resources to monitor sexual offenders.
I totally know that this not is not entrapment, but this is not terribly far removed from entrapment. If you want to get all of the people that have ever been convicted of a sexual offense off the street, create as many stumbling blocks along the way that you can to get them to trip up, so that now you have a legal reason to arrest them. I realize it's not entrapment where the person wasn't going to do the crime, but you have the lady that's in Oklahoma who can't go to a park now because she had sex as a 19-year-old with a 17-year-old.
That was Shauna, I believe.
She's a 30-year-old married woman with two kids. It's not even related, but now they've created all these barriers. Now she can't get a job, etc. They've created all these stumbling blocks for her to have any reasonable level of success in her world. All under the guise of a JonBenet Ramsey kind of situation, just like pretty girl abducted, disappears, But that's not what she did, and that's not what a significant number of people on the registry have done. But the public just is out for blood.
They are, and I think that we've not been successful for a number of reasons in educating the public that there are very few predators on the registry. If they really knew how few, quote, predators, those people are locked up, and they're generally locked up for a very long time. Sandusky will never be out again. But the broad universe of sexual offenders is so large. But the average person in the public, as I talked to the people at the hotel venue, they were generally sympathetic and said they didn't have any idea of all the things that could land one on the registry. They thought it was pretty much bad guys.
Yeah, that's what people think.
And it is a sinister situation where all these things they accumulate and stack up that the people can't you can't ever get past it. It's what are we going to do if you can never go back and be a productive member of society for one mistake, which may not be a very significant one, having sex with someone you're in love with just because there's a magic dividing line on age. What do you have to do to redeem yourself for not knowing that you shouldn't have had raging hormones?
And we will put someone on trial, age of 12, in for life in prison and on death row. Is that I know I, that has come up. Maybe I just went too far, but they will put someone in prison. They will try them for an adult crime as a 12-year-old. But the victim will never have their status elevated to be considered an adult for this.
Correct. You
And
got
that's the
it.
way we want it.
That's the way they want it.
And we're all okay with this.
Well, not all of us are not okay with it. There's a couple that are not.
Did we cover everything about Persky? Did we miss anything that you wanted to finish up on?
Well, I'm really troubled because I think that it's only the tip of the iceberg. I touched on the monitoring panels I think that will form to monitor judges, particularly in California. And I believe it'll expand beyond California. I believe that a lot of people that are that, even though that mandatory 3 years only applies to people who committed their offenses after that law passed, that's going to be applied to people now. Because in the case of Judge Persky with Brock Turner, he had the option of sentencing him up to 14 years, as I understand. He gave the minimal amount of 6 months. And I think that he actually had the option of doing probation completely. Not even sure that 6 months was a mandatory minimum. But I'm afraid that all the cases that are in the pipeline, awaiting sentencing, many even unindicted charges that occurred prior to this law, the judges are not going to want to be Persky'd, which I mean, you might say Persky'd recalled, which means that they're going to say, well, I've got a sentence harshly enough to not be Persky'd. Which means that despite the attorney's best efforts, what sentences that are in the pipeline are going to dramatically increase because of the fear factor. I know judges shouldn't. We should have a magic person who holds the robe, who doesn't have family to support, doesn't have kids to put through college, doesn't have a mortgage payment, doesn't have the desire to live a relatively comfortable life. We should have people like that, but we don't. They're normal mortals who deal with the same things, and they're not going to want to have their lives turned upside down by this a recall effort, which means that rather than having their life turned upside down, they're going to alter their sentencing practices, which means we've now got a new baseline, which is even much harsher, which I don't think is moving us in the direction we want to go.
It's adding, so you have your not all states, but you have your House and your Senate for at your state level. Those are the people that you had to convince to move in your direction. Now you then have to also convince the judges. Yeah, you have influence over all three branches. You can punish the executive branch, you can punish the legislative branch, now you can punish the judicial branch for your policy that you want to implement.
You're correct, and it's a good way of I haven't even quite phrased it like that, but now you, the public, and I'm going to refer to it as mob rule. The mob rule is now able to shove its will through the legislative branch, through the executive branch, and now through the judicial branch. You will do what we want, or else. And that what we want is harsh sentencing.
And but there, I still just it's not designed that way. It's
It wasn't
designed
designed that way.
that the executive branch appoints the legislate, the, excuse me, the judges. The people vote for the legislature and they vote for the executive branch. The judicial branch is supposed to be sort of removed from the political process, kind of, sort of. It's it would be, a Republican executor is going to then likely nominate Republican judges. But yeah, now, not only are you voting for your legislature, you're quote unquote voting for your judges too, and that just seems like just bad.
Well, we've been voting for judges at state level for a long time, but the mechanism to turn them out of office either didn't exist or it was seldom successful because the people in an earlier era would have said, no, I'm not going to take the judge out of office for doing his or her job. But now the Me Too movement and the victims' advocacy is so strong. This was hailed as a victory for women. And that's what it's being portrayed as a victory for women. And for victims, which are primarily in the sexual offenses, or more women than the men, this is being hailed as a victory. And I was on one of my plane rides on the way to conference, and I had the audacity to say that it was a maybe it is a victory if you want to look at it that way, but it's an extreme defeat and disaster for the rule of law. And I didn't get a lot of support for that position from the passengers around me.
Can you extend it past sexual offenses to where do you think maybe like the second layer of impact that this might have be on different kinds of crimes? You did mention drunk driving a minute ago, but can you something a little less obvious?
Well, the statute of limitations and the confrontation clause, when they remove the statute of limitations, they're going after sexual related offenses as a top priority. But in the case of, I believe, Maryland, they don't have a statute of limitations for any felony level offense. When the statute of limitations is eradicated, and we've already weakened the confrontation clause through victims' rights that they have. Like there's an attorney in the state of Connecticut that I'm trying to think of his name. That's what happens when you get old, Norm Pattiz, who recently had a successful acquittal where he did some very harsh cross-examination about a victim's relationship and sexual experience. That's not permitted in most states. You're not allowed to confront. That's re-victimization, as far as the victim's advocates say. And when we can no longer ask the person on the stand, do you have any motivation to lie? And we can't put if we can't put in rebuttal evidence to challenge what they're saying, if all these things are re-victimizing them, we're pretty much out of business. There won't be any trials because there'll be no need to. All the accuser just says that and this would extrapolate down the line to all criminality. Domestic violence, I think we talked to roughly briefly on another podcast, it's an unreported crime. A lot of domestic violence goes unreported. And more often than not, victims are going to be women, although men are abused and battered with frying pans and all sorts of things happen to men as well. But those things, for a number of reasons, go unreported. But we would never yet tolerate if someone called the police and said, I want to report a domestic violence. Well, when did it occur? I think it'd be in August 1978. Oh, well, it was 40 years ago. Well, we'll get right on that. We'll get an investigation. We'll go lock the guy up. They don't tolerate that with domestic violence. It is horrible that people are abused, and for so many reasons they can't come forward, and it goes unpunished. But domestic violence has to be reported in real time. The police come out and look at the scene. This dwelling we're sitting in right now, they'd be looking for evidence of disarray, and any broken glass or dishes, any markings on the victim. And if it were an apartment complex or close enough for neighbors, they'd be wanting to go talk to neighbors and find out if there's any corroborative evidence that can be shown that this actually happened. But in the case of sexual offenses, same thing. A lot of it goes unreported for a number of reasons. But you can't come forward 40 years later because the person is at an extreme disadvantage. Witnesses have died. Physical evidence has vanished or deteriorated altogether, And we have no way of validating, and it is your job as a victim. You have to prove the accusation that you're making. I'm sorry to tell you that. I didn't make the rule. That is the rule. If you're going to accuse someone of criminality, the burden is on you to prove your allegation. Same thing in a civil proceeding. If that car that you drove up, if I go out and see that I have a gash in the side of my car, I have to prove it was your car that did it. I can't just speculate because you were here that that was mine and well, he was here today. I have to have something in the way of evidence, either a video or a paint analysis or something. It's my job to prove that you damaged my car if I'm going to accuse you of doing that. Victims realize that you have to prove what you're accusing someone of doing.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. Possibly the last topic to go over was something that Dubling said, that this will be, these battles will be fought at the state level. And the reason why I think that this is such a critical point to bring home is I think people are looking for a knock it out of the park kind of thing that'll just make the whole thing collapse. And we've talked about that, and it's poppycock. But another thing that was brought up along those same lines is find the tiny little bite of the elephant that you can get. If it is just pulling back of some piece of the regulation, even like residency restrictions, like 1,000 foot, 2,500, whatever it is, that might be too heavy of a lift. But something with like the driver's license thing that we were just talking about, where if we can just make tiny little inroads, it's easier to persuade a politician. And this has to be done at your state level. NARSAL can't step in and do it. None of the other national organizations could step in. They can help you. But these things have to be done by us at our local level to affect our people, that our parents or our brothers and sisters can help affect us for positive. Thoughts?
Well, I agree with Paul, and it's not a message that's easy to deliver because our people want that instant. Well, I don't know if it's just our people. I think Americans and Westerners are used to instant gratification. And it's hard for us in this advocacy to be clear on what it is we're achieving and why we should even be supported, because we don't have a simple message. The beast is too large. The people that fight for First Amendment rights, they have a simple message. They're coming for our guns. The Second Amendment. They're coming for our guns, and they scare the hell out of you that they're coming. Of course, no one ever proposes coming for your guns, but they tell you that. And we don't have a line like that, because we have this multifaceted. We don't have just a single thing, the guns that they're coming for. We have the driver's license. We have the proximity restriction. We have the residency restriction. We have the length of registration. We have the frequency of reporting, whether it was retroactive or not. We have on and on and on with all these different facets of this beast, and we're trying to tackle a plethora of them.
And every state is different, too.
And every state is different, which means people say, well, what the hell are you people doing? And that came up multiple times at the conference. What is it? Why should we support you? And I thought about that a lot. And I said, well, I can see your point, because we really are not clearly communicating what we're doing. And I tell them in my state, it's very clear what I'm doing. I'm holding the line until we can do better. We're keeping your life from getting worse until we can make your life better. We made your life a little bit better in 2013 when we uniformly across the state prohibited state, city and county governments from imposing any restrictions on you. We made your life better. We are going to hold the line until we can do better again when we have more favorable political climate. We don't make the political climate, the voters do. We do the best we can to adapt to what we've got because that's really the only choice we have. They send people to our capital and we analyze and figure out what we can accomplish with those people that the voters, the cards that they dealt us. And for the last 3 or 4 years, it's been hold the line is all we can do. No one is interested in moving forward with any type of reform related to registration. Not a, in a positive way. They're quite willing to move forward to reform to add additional obligations and make it tougher. But we're in a holding pattern. But across the country, it varies from state to state in terms of what their priorities are, and we don't have this unified message. Like, if you're from legalization of marijuana, it's a simple message. We're for legalized use, recreational use of marijuana. That's what the that's easy to message. We're for a woman's reproductive rights. That's easy to message. We don't have anything easy to message.
Couldn't we though? I mean, a couple of conferences ago, the message was LEO, Leo for the registry.
Law enforcement only registry.
And wouldn't that be that would for but that would be a single campaign for one thing.
We thought that when we launched that campaign, we thought that would be something that would resonate. And then we took a lot of criticism from our own people. They said, well, if you people are against the registry the way you say you are, how could you advocate for a law enforcement registry? What the hell's wrong with you people? And then you get into a philosophical debate about which is a better which is better. Do you prioritize abolishing the registry, or do you concede and become a sellout and say it's okay to have a registry as long as it's for law enforcement only? We get chastised from both sides on that issue, but we thought that that would be a unifying message of law enforcement only, because if we're going to have it, keep it out of the hands of the public.
I was just using that as an example of a single message. But we
Yeah.
would still then still have another dozen or 20 other things, residency restrictions, work proximity restrictions, going to parks, playgrounds. The list is very long. But it would seem that, well, I mean, wouldn't MAD have something, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, wouldn't they have something, whatever the blood alcohol limit is, they would at one point say that it's 0.1, and then it'd be 0.9, and they would keep changing the message as they go along, or
That's what they've done. That's what mothers do. But not mothers, generally, what mothers against drunk driving. I don't want all the mothers out there listening to be mad, but that's what they've done. They move the goalposts as they're successful. It's not. It's never. They're never happy, because if they said, "Well, we've got where we want to be. We're at an acceptable level of drunk driving," then it's hard to con people to making the massive donations and get the government grants that they get.
just I did when we covered the Rush Limbaugh 250,000 people die by knives. I ended up looking at the deaths by vehicle fatalities and all that. If I'm not mistaken, it's between 10 and 15,000 people a year die per year out of the 30,000 in vehicle deaths through drunk driving. I'm pretty sure, just in comparison, it's not necessarily a fair way to compare it. Very, 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 very few people are dying through sexual offenses.
I would want to hope that's the case. I think we would hear about it if it were anything to the contrary.
But it almost has been normalized away from it being anything that gets covered on television, that so many people die by drunk driving.
And then we'll be criticized for trying to equate the horrors of a sexual offense, the trauma of it lasts a lifetime.
Well, okay, let's try it this way then. Lately, and this is right up my alley. I just follow all the tech news. I'm a big Tesla aficionado and the self-driving cars, and we go back and forth on the automation side of things a lot. But in the news lately, you've been hearing about many deaths by autonomous cars. But by statistics, by numbers alone, those cars drive millions of miles without incident. And then one hits the news, and now everyone's going to be in an uproar that these autonomous vehicles are unsafe. How many fatalities have there been by autonomous cars, and the numbers in the single digits, still we're at 30,000 or something like that by other vehicle fatalities.
You have to, you would have to put the analysis to how many of the automatic non-human driven cars and put it in a ratio against the total vehicles on the road, and you'd also find that's an infinitesimally small number,
Agreed.
I would think. But the uproar becomes because the population's not convinced that the computer's smarter. So ultimately, if a person couldn't have been there to override the machine, then they feel unsafer. It's like the pilot. You could do a lot of airplane movements without a human, but people don't feel safe because the humans there can make the ultimate decision and override the computer if need be.
I was,
And
and I'm bringing it up from the sensationalization point of view of when these incredibly rare events happen, they end up in the news, it has a disproportionately larger impact on the psyche of society, of their safety, due to their insignificance, therefore being newsworthy. If it's something that happens every day, no one gives a shit because it's just a regular occurrence of things.
I agree that we become desensitized, and these rare incidents of child abductions, they're exceedingly rare in this nation. It's something around 100 a year of stranger abductions. Not much. It's certainly less than 200 a year in recent years, and it becomes it one would be devastating if it were your child abducted by a stranger, but it's so exceedingly rare, and as I've said on previous episodes, we're safer now than any point in modern times. As a child or as an adult, we're safer. This is the best time to be alive. And I know the people in Chicago would be laughing if I'm saying that, statistically nationwide, this is the best time to be an American from a criminal safety perspective.
Last on the list would be you can't always, we can pick who we elect, whether you're on Team Blue or Team Red. But after that's in play, then you have to work within, if you want to play baseball on my diamond, then you have to play by my rules. There is a different tactic that someone would take in a blue versus a red legislature. And I wanted to try and quickly cover. Just in concept, I want to go into this in a great more detail, but just kind of just lay it out there for people to think about. That when you go talk to a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, you have to deliver the talking points that are going to resonate with them, even though you're trying to accomplish the same mission. But instead of going it over the left side of the mountain, you have to go over the right side of the mountain. Do you think that you could quickly give us something of an example of how to navigate that landscape?
It is true. You have to figure out what their where they are and what their response is going to be. Likely, when you go see a conservative, if they're true to their values, some are still, some liberals are true to their values, and some are inconsistent and wishy-washy depending on what they analyze the politics to be. But if you're talking to a true conservative, I think Rand Paul in the U.S. Senate would be an example. He's been very critical of the runaway spending that's being done by this so-called conservative administration, ballooning the deficit, and he's willing to call them out on it. He's being intellectually honest. When you talk to someone from a conservative perspective, they're generally going to be concerned about fiscal responsibility, and you can craft a message around that. So when you're wanting to reduce the prison population, you're not going to go tell a conservative that we're better off as a society to divert these people because we can rehabilitate them and feeling soft good stuff that appeals to a liberal. But you can go tell them, I tell you, we're looking at our budget and we're looking at our spending priorities, and I know that you want to do a whole lot of things that are you're being constrained by our runaway prison cost. And therefore, I think that we look at our prison population and give them some key facts that we've got at least a third of them in our prison that are in for relatively minor offenses, and we could probably save X number of dollars by redirecting these resources to other priorities. And you don't have to be specific on the priorities, but redirection of resources that will appeal to a conservative. wouldn't appeal much to a liberal, but it would appeal to a conservative. A liberal, when you start talking about reducing the prison population, you're talking about rehabilitation, and you're talking about touchy-feely good stuff for them. But ultimately, you can get to the same result because both camps will agree that they want to reduce the prison population, but for different reasons,
And by a different mechanism.
by a different mechanism. But if you're truly wanting to get people out of prison, you may have to compromise on how you do it and what the mechanism is to reduce the population. I might want to early release people that are already in there because of some matrix I put together to look at their offense and the ratio of the time that they've served. And that may not be agreeable to someone else, but we will get to the same result with different messages. And that's what was being talked about at the conference. You can actually come up with a campaign. When you're talking about the Me Too movement, the liberals are going to be very sympathetic to the women who come in because they need the women to vote. The Democrats are more likely to be on the winning side of women voters. And if they were to be unsympathetic to those who are coming with the Me Too message that we need to be tougher on we need to stop allowing the attorneys to re-victimize us as victims on the stand, they're going to be very receptive to that, even though supposedly they're for due process. They get themselves in an intellectual pretzel when you start, because you say, well, you do as a good progressive believe in do. Well, of course I do. Well, you do believe that the conference. Oh, well, yes, I do. But then they're in that pretzel of the victims' lobby saying that you guys are not sympathetic to us as victims, and so you have to craft a different message. And I haven't quite come up with that message because I'm still working on it. I was talking to a guy from Massachusetts, which has a substantial Democratic majority in their legislature, and they're having trouble pushing back on the statute of limitations and things because he said the Democrats are just falling right into line and doing what the victims groups want. And I said, well, I understand why they're doing it because of the politics of they don't want to alienate a substantial block of Democratic voters. And the former Attorney General explained that in his reasons, which will be available on the playback on the recordings when they make it on the internet. He explained to them the politics of why, as a liberal attorney general in a relatively moderate to conservative state, he went along with the implementation of the federal Adam Walsh standards in Ohio.
Well, lastly, did you receive any feedback about the podcast at the conference?
I received a fair number of comments about us. I really did.
Did you receive any negative ones?
I don't think I could classify any feedback as negative. I'd had people say that we use too much jargon that everyone doesn't understand. That's really the closest thing would approximate negative, but it
So
was
otherwise,
overwhelmingly positive.
Shamelessly, it was 100% positive feedback.
Unfortunately, I guess you could say that it was very positive, but very few people are going to come up to you at a conference and say you guys suck. I would think that would not be likely, but I got that constructive feedback that we should never assume that new listeners, if we're trying to reach a broader market, that people may tune in for the first time and not know what the heck we're talking about when we say AWA and SORNA and different phrases. They said especially attorneys tend to talk that way and they lose their listeners.
I think we should wrap it up. I've got to get on the road and get home. And so if you want to reach out to us, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You could phone in questions, which would be absolutely the best appreciated. And that's 747-227-4477. You can support us at patreon.com/registrymatters. And for those of you who don't know, feel free to subscribe. You'll get notified of new episodes coming out, and you can find that at registrymatters.co. It's not com, it's not a .com, it's a .co address. And I think this is episode 30 that we're recording. The one that we did in the restaurant was episode 29. And I don't have anything else. I appreciate it, Larry.
I'm glad to be here. I'm glad we got this one done.
It really sucked to see you for the first time in a year. I hope we don't have to do it again for another year. And I will talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thanks.